that we have to avoid. And even if it's a Muslim country, Islamic country, you'll find many Muslim countries fighting each other using technology and science and technology that they've developed, right? Yeah. Or they're using, essentially developed by other countries. That is essentially the result of not considering what Islam says about guidance. So if they're not very well guided through Islamic ethics, then definitely they will consider themselves Islamic countries, but they will do things exactly opposite to what Islam is teaching using the science and technology that they've developed.
You know, it was a nice chat, I think. So this was all the time that we have for today. And we are your station. We are here with the goal of development. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When it comes to Peru, the country is unraveling quickly. Just last week, Peru's president, Pedro Castillo, was removed from office. His charge, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress and install a government of exception. This occurred just before he was due to face an impeachment vote. Then came his arrest, charged with allegedly breaching constitutional order. But these accusations were not enough. He was also accused of an attempted coup. Enter Castillo's vice president, Dina Boluarte. She also accused the president of a coup attempt. And just a few short hours later, she was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. Boluarte called for a political truce and the installation of a national unity government. No surprise that the coup set up mass protests all across Peru. This is while the unelected government ordered a violent crackdown, with police to have killed numerous protesters. Yet things have moved rather too quickly, leading one to conclude that there may be foreign hands at play, in this instance, from the U.S. For example, just 2 days before a coup against its elected President Castillo, the ex-CIA agent and U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's defense minister. And there are reports that Peru's defense minister, who's a retired brigadier general, ordered the military to turn against Castillo. The U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's unelected leader, Dina Boluarte, and reiterated Washington's wholehearted support. Kenna, in another post, tweeted, "The U.S. categorically rejects any extra constitutional act by President Castillo to prevent Congress from fulfilling its mandate." This all showed that the U.S. government had staunchly supported Peru's unelected administration. In the statement, the U.S. State Department stated, the U.S. commends Peru's institutions and authorities for safeguarding democratic stability. Troubled by violent demonstrations and reports of attacks on the press and private property, the U.S. recognizes Dina Boluarte as the country's president. When Castillo moved to dissolve Congress, he cited Article 134, and he made it clear that it was only going to be a temporary closure. He said new congressional elections would be held as soon as possible. Yet the U.S. ambassador to Peru failed to mention Article 134 of Peru's constitution, which states, the president of the republic is authorized to dissolve Congress if it has censured or denied its confidence to two councils of ministers. The dissolution decree contains the call for elections for a new Congress. The U.S. Ambassador Kenna ignored all of this. Instead, she declared, the U.S. emphatically urges President Castillo to reverse his attempt to close Congress and allow the democratic institutions of Peru to function according to the Constitution. By this, the CIA veteran meant that Castillo should simply allow the anti-democratic Congress to launch a coup against him. The U.S. Embassy in Peru subsequently published an official statement echoing exactly what Kenna had said. This was Washington's green light for Peru's right-wing-dominated Congress to overthrow President Castillo and for the state security services to arrest him without trial. So it's no surprise there have been headlines that read, the U.S. egged on the coup in Peru. The move by Pedro Castillo to dissolve Congress ahead of a third impeachment motion seems to be the result of a pressure campaign with support from the U.S. But why would the U.S. be interested in a coup in Peru? One motivation behind the U.S. could be in Peru's natural resources. Peru has a wealth of mineral resources like copper, iron, lead, and zinc. Gold and silver are also found extensively. On the other hand, the U.S. has been against the group of left-wing presidents who have taken over in Latin America in what's called the pink tide, with many not leaning so much towards the West's economic and financial system, like from the U.S. After all, they did not reap the rewards that a Western capital system offers, which has turned out to be just a mirage. Brazil's president Lula da Silva has even said that it wants to move away from the dollar and decrease the dependency as much as possible. The CIA has organized many coups against democratically elected left-wing leaders in Latin America, from Guatemala's president Jacobo Arbenz in 1954 to Chile's president Salvador Allende in 1973, not to mention the attempts to remove the former Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez.
Japan is allocating $320 billion in an effort to build up its military, a move that would be unthinkable under previous administrations. But now, under the Liberal Democratic Party led by Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, surveys say the budget has the favor of over 70% of voters. The military developments include extending the range of Japan's missiles, stockpiling of spare parts and other munitions, reinforcing logistics, developing cyber warfare capabilities, and cooperating more with U.S. and other like-minded countries. The extension of the range of Japanese missiles is only meant to be able to reach China, if the need were to ever arise, as there is no other reason to extend the range to around 1,000 kilometers. The reason why Japan feels the need to advance its missile technology is the escalation of tensions in the Indo-Pacific region. North Korea has, on multiple occasions, tested intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads, one of which landed a little too close for comfort to Japan. The China-Taiwan tensions are also cause for concern for Japan, as a potential military escalation could put Japan in danger as well. This is because of the large number of troops and massive amounts of supplies that the U.S. has stationed in Japan, which they would most likely take advantage of in case of an escalation with Taiwan. Here's what Prime Minister Kishida said with regards to the military build-up plan.
We can feel a rapid increase in the severity of the security environment around our country. In countries and the regions surrounding our country, a strengthening of nuclear and missile capabilities, a rapid military build-up, and attempts to unilaterally change the status quo through power are becoming more pronounced.
Kishida also emphasized on the issue of China as a challenge to its security. He said, China's current external stance and military trends are a challenge to our country's peace and security, the securing of global peace and stability, and the enhancement of international order based on the rule of law. To which Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin responded by saying, Japan disregards the facts, deviates from the common understandings between China and Japan, and its commitment to bilateral relations, and discredits China. Japan even believes that Russia is a threat to its security, albeit indirectly. Tokyo sees Russia's war in Ukraine as a dangerous precedent that might encourage China to carry out a similar operation in Taiwan and cause unimaginable disruption to world trade. By taking stances against North Korea, China, and Russia, Japan must look to the US and South Korea as its allies. $320 billion. Once the budget is injected into Japan's military, it will bump up Japan's ranking among the top military spenders in the world from 8th place all the way up to 3rd place, just below the US and China, even higher than Russia during a time of war. And this amount of expenditure is going to hurt Japanese economy. Kishida's plans will double Japan's defense outlays to about 2% of the country's gross domestic product over the next 5 years. It would also mean that Japan's defense ministry will now have 10% of the country's entire annual public spending. In the document that outlines the plan for the military expenditures, what is not included is how the money will come about. It's unclear whether the government will have to raise money through tax increases or whether it will borrow the money. But if we look at the reason behind this unprecedented amount of spending on military by Japan, that is known for its pacifist constitution, we will realize that if not for the US's recent provocative actions, Japan would not deem its security threatened. North Korea's ICBM missile tests only came about as a result of US provocations, and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has mentioned this on multiple occasions. With regards to the issue of Taiwan, if not for the meddling of the US in Taiwan's affairs and the breaking of the One China policy that the US had previously agreed to, China would not have conducted the biggest military exercise in its history. If not for the constant eastward expansion of NATO, spearheaded by the US, the war in Ukraine would also not have happened, and Japan's concerns over Russia encouraging China to also attack Taiwan would never come to be. It's almost as if Japan's alliance with the US is costing them more money than it's bringing in. And that is completely disregarding the security risks that this alliance has brought upon the land of the rising sun.
Iran has wrapped the European Union over anti-Tehran measures taken by the Council of the European Union. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian denounced, quote, certain political shows that have been put on display by the Council under the pretext of defending the issue of human rights. The European Council has imposed a slew of fresh sanctions against Iranian natural and legal entities. According to a statement issued by the EU foreign ministers, 20 individuals, along with one entity, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, have been sanctioned over alleged human rights abuses. The bloc has also slapped sanctions on 4 more people and as many entities blacklisted over Tehran's alleged drone supplies to Russia. The bloc's new sanctions include asset freezes and travel bans to the EU. The ministers condemned what they called the widespread use of force by the Iranian authorities against protesters. The European Union last month imposed sanctions on a number of Iranian institutions and individuals, including the 24-hour English-language press TV news channel, over alleged rights violations following the recent foreign-backed riots in the country.
In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats, they support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
Foreign-backed riots have hit various Iranian provinces since 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini died at the hospital on September 16th, 3 days after she collapsed at a police station. An investigation has attributed Amini's death to a medical condition rather than alleged beatings by the police. The violent riots have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces while also allowing terrorist attacks across the country. In the last 2 months, the terrorists have set fire to public property and tortured several Basiji members and security forces to death. Western states have been hyper-aggressively pushing the regime change agenda in form of hybrid war, making a sheer mockery of international law. Authorities in the US and the EU have openly and brazenly instigated rioters in Iran through official and unofficial channels. Iran's intelligence ministry has said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest.
Online, the MEK organization that's funded by and supported by NATO, they've been teaching people how to make Molotov cocktails, how to use weapons, and they've been attacking police bases, military bases, and also we've had terrorist attacks alongside the Pakistani border, in the no man land in Pakistan, and also in northern Iraq from Iraqi Kurdistan.
Iran says its enemies have waged a hybrid war against the Islamic Republic to weaken national solidarity and hinder the country's progress. Officials say huge amounts of weapons have been shipped into the country by Western and regional intelligence services to carry out terrorist attacks and conduct extensive psychological operations in order to stoke dissatisfaction amongst the Iranian people and make them accuse the Iranian administration for the growing insecurity.
The United States is finalizing plans to send Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The plan needs the final approval of U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin and the U.S. President Joe Biden. It is not known how many of the batteries will be sent to Ukraine, but reports say supplies to Ukraine will be limited. But according to available data, a typical Patriot battery includes a radar set that detects and tracks targets, computers, and a power-generating equipment. It also includes an engagement control station and up to 8 launchers, each holding 4 radio-fire missiles. The systems are likely to be sent to the U.S. Army base in Grafenwöhr, Germany, where Ukrainian soldiers are likely to be trained and use the equipment. Ukraine has long been requesting the U.S. to send advanced long-range air defense system.
The message is simple. Give Patriots as soon as you can. Because this is the system that Ukraine needs to protect its civilian population and critical infrastructure. This is not an offensive weapon.
Russia has already warned that Patriot missile systems in Ukraine, if are deployed in the conflict, will be targeted. The former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, who is now Deputy Chair of the National Security Council, had earlier warned that such weapons and their crews would be legitimate targets
if a NATO member were to deliver them.
Вашингтон уже сделал себя стороной конфликта в практической плоскости. Принимая во внимание растущие объемы прямой американской военной помощи, включая присутствие военнослужащих США на земле, передача столь сложного вооружения, обращение с которым требует многомесячной подготовки, будет означать расширение вовлеченности кадровых американских военных в боевые действия со всеми вытекающими последствиями. Настоятельно советуем тем, кто в Вашингтоне принимает решение, наконец прислушаться, возможно, не к нам, но к самим себе, сделать правильные выводы из наших неоднократных предупреждений о том, что любые поставляемые на Украину оружейные системы, в том числе Patriot, соответственно, обслуживающим персоналом, были и остаются законными приоритетными целями для вооруженных сил России.
The U.S. and its Western partners have already resupplied Ukraine's air defense missiles and shoulder-fired Stinger missiles and other larger air defense systems. Patriot missile system is one of the most advanced U.S. systems against aircraft and missiles. Ukrainian officials say the delivery of Patriot missiles would be a game changer. But the efficiency of those weapons for Ukraine in the war against Russia is not clear. Each missile battery would require dozens of well-trained air defenders to operate. Even with an accelerated training program, could be sometime in early 2023 before a system is operational in Ukraine. Experts believe the Patriot has a more powerful radar that is better at discriminating targets, but it has its own limitations. Its efficiency would depend on how the weapon was delivered. The success rate of the Patriot has been repeatedly questioned. In 2018, Saudi Arabia's success in using Patriots against missiles fired in the Yemen war were questioned when evidence of systems failing emerged. The Patriot does not reportedly perform so well against small drones. It is not known whether the system's radar could pick up the small, low-flying drones or whether there were other issues. The U.S. has now committed more than $19.3 billion in weapons and other equipment to Ukraine since the war began in February of this year.
As we work with industry to accelerate production on both replenishment systems and direct procurements under the United Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, or USAI, we're using a number of tools to get the funding moving and the contracting happen quickly. These include using contracting mechanisms called things like undefinitized contracting actions, sometimes called UCAs. What that allows you to do deliberately is to get industry working on an initial contract before we definitize it. And you can put a UCA together within a week, and we're doing that. We also are making use of indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts, or IDIQ. If you have IDIQs, and we have many of them, what you can do is just add task orders to them very quickly to get equipment on contract.
It is widely believed that those U.S.-made weapons are fanning the flames of war in Europe. But there are concerns that those weapons are falling into the wrong hands.
We're seeing this incredible, historic flow of weapons coming into Ukraine. Do we have any sense as to where they're going?
We don't know. There is really no information as to where they're going at all.
You know, all this stuff goes to the border, and then kind of like something happens, it kind of like 30% maybe reaches its final destination.
Washington is reportedly looking into technological solutions to the problem of weapons diversion. Western weapons earmarked for Ukraine had reportedly surfaced in the hands of militant groups in the African Sahel.
Limelight. Armed police used tear gas in clashes with football fans in Paris on Sunday night, 18th of December, after France's World Cup defeat to Argentina. Around 14,000 police officers were on duty across France to keep order. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. Armed police used tear gas on the streets of Paris on Sunday night, 18th of December, after disorder broke out following the World Cup defeat to Argentina. Football fans descended en masse to the streets of the country's biggest cities, Paris, Lyon and Nice, after the game. Police officers quelled the disturbance in the Champs-Élysées as flares were ignited and fireworks went off. Meanwhile, similar scenes played out in Madrid, Spain, as jubilant Argentinian fans flooded the streets of Madrid in celebration. Pictures showed a huge crowd of fans in white and blue in the city's main square celebrating after their team defeated France. However, some clashes broke out with police, with photographs showing armed officers beating supporters with batons. One man was seen being ushered away by police. Around 14,000 police officers went on duty across France on Sunday night, 18th of December, to guarantee security as Les Blues took on Argentina in the World Cup final. The Parisian security operation presented to the French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin publicly on Friday saw a concentration of forces in Paris, where huge crowds were expected in the event of a victory. The Champs-Élysées Avenue was the scene of vast celebrations during France's previous World Cup triumphs back in 1998 and 2018, with 600,000 people cheering and dancing there 4 years ago. The avenue was closed to traffic on Sunday, and 2,750 police officers were stationed in the vicinity. Police were on their guard for troublemakers after around 40 far-right sympathizers arrested on Wednesday evening as they attempted to join a crowd of revelers after France beat Morocco in the semi-final. They had come to start a fight, the French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin told reporters. The aftermath of last Wednesday's game was also marred by the death of a 14-year-old teenage boy in the southern French city of Montpellier, who was hit by a car carrying supporters. The driver of a white hatchback involved in the accident is still being sought by French police. With concrete blocks painted blue, white and red, police had sealed off the Champs-Élysées to traffic in anticipation of it flooding with celebrating crowds on Sunday. People did gather and fireworks were fired into the sky when France twice equalized, but they were left with a feeling of disappointment. By contrast, hundreds of thousands of Argentinian football fans poured into the sunlit streets of Buenos Aires on Sunday, ecstatic after a nail-biting victory on penalties in the World Cup final over France made the South Americans world champions for the first time since 1986. In a tense and roller coaster match played in Qatar in front of some 88,000 fans, Argentina, led by star Lionel Messi, took home its third World Cup after beating France, the defending champions, 4-2 on penalties after drawing 3-3 after extra time. British newspaper The Sun has also covered the same story. Riot cops tear gas fans in France on Sunday night as clashes erupted across the country after Argentina's sensational World Cup win. Thousands of football fans poured into the streets of Paris, Nice and Lyon after France lost to Argentina 4-2 on penalties in Qatar. Riot cops clashed with fans on the famous Champs-Élysées Boulevard in the French capital as flares were lit up and fireworks hit the skies after the tense game. In Lyon, riot police reportedly fired tear gas on football fans as violence broke out in the city. Shocking video footage showed chaotic scenes as supporters draped in flags hurled rocks, bottles and fireworks at police officers before officers fired tear gas on the crowds. Cops could be heard yelling "turn around" at rioters as water cannons reportedly moved in to break up the crowds. Another video clip showed a group of fans pummeling cars with rocks and rubbish before riot police chased them down the street. Dozens have been arrested in the city, according to reports. French police also responded to unrest in the Mediterranean French city of Nice on Sunday night, 18th of December. French newspaper Le Figaro reported clashes took place with police and garbage bins were set alight in Nice. Video footage shows a heavy police presence in central Nice. A fire can be seen burning on a rubbish-strewn street. Riots have erupted across Europe after several World Cup games in recent weeks. Last Wednesday, a 14-year-old teenage boy was killed when violent clashes erupted across France following their World Cup victory over Morocco. Police were pummeled by fireworks in Paris as thousands poured into the streets to celebrate after France beat Morocco 2-0 to reach the final. Shocking video footage showed chaotic scenes as fans bombarded riot cops with a stream of fireworks before officers were forced to flee the line of fire. Another video clip in the French capital Paris showed police pushing back fans as they set off flares at the Champs-Élysées. Rowdy fans chanted as hundreds of cars paraded past the crowds, sounding their horns and waving flags from the windows. French cops said 115 arrests had been made in Paris by the early hours of Thursday morning, 15th of December, according to Le Parisien. In the French city of Montpellier, shocking video footage also showed fans chucking chairs, fireworks and rocks at riot police and climbing the landmark fountain in the city.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, believing in hereafter. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of believing in hereafter in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, we know that a Muslim is a person who believes in a God, who believes in the prophethood, who believes in the hereafter or the day of judgment. These are the basic three things. Apart from that, in the Shia Islam, obviously, we know that when we believe in God, we also believe in God to be just. He is a just. So after that, when we believe in the Nabuwa, we also believe in Imamate. And then the fifth factor, the principle, is to believe on the Day of Judgment. So these are the basic things. Therefore, in order to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to believe in the hereafter, in the life after the death. And we believe that there is a life after that. Why? Because everything that we are performing in this world, we all are answerable to what we are doing. So when we are answerable to our actions, to our deeds in this life, and we are performing this, if we are answerable in hereafter, then we will be very, very much careful about what we are doing. Because we know that if we perform good deeds, we're going to have reward in hereafter. If we perform bad deeds, we will have the punishment. And there are some charges in hereafter. So when a person living an Islamic lifestyle believes on the Day of Judgment, he believes in the life after the death, he lives a very careful life in this material world, then he will use this material world in order to achieve the ranks and the status and the earnings for hereafter. And he spends his thinking, thoughts, working, and actions for the hereafter, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of believing in hereafter in the Islamic lifestyle. We said it is necessary to believe in hereafter or the life after death in the Islamic lifestyle because our actions, our deeds, our way of living depends on this. Because when someone knows that he is answerable, even if he's alone, he will not commit a sin because he knows that Allah can see I'm answerable for my actions. My body parts will witness against me if I do something wrong, or they will witness in my favor if I do something right. So this is necessary to have this belief. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala clearly said in the Quran in chapter 2, verse 62, and I want the attention of all listeners, whether they're Jews, they're Christians or Muslims, that in chapter 2, verse number 62, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, certainly those who believed, means Muslims, وَالَّذِينَ هَادُوا, and those who are Jew, وَالنَّصَارَى, and those who are Christians, وَالصَّابِئِينَ, and those who are the Sabians, man amana billah, whoever believes in Allah as Allah, one God. Wal yawmil akhir, and the day of judgment, wa amila salihan, and they perform good deeds, falahum, therefore for them is ajruhum, there is a reward for them, inda rabbihim, near their God. Wala khawfun alayhim, wala hum yahzanun, they will neither have a fear nor a grieve of what they have done. So basically, if you are a Christian, if you are a Jew, if you are a Muslim, if you are a Sabian, if you believe in one God, if you believe in Allah to be the God, Allah to be the God, if you believe on the day of judgment, and if you perform good deeds, then obviously there is a reward for you. So believing in hereafter is from the necessities of the religion. It's from the basics and the principles of the religion that we need to have this. And in order to have an Islamic lifestyle, we should believe in hereafter so that our lifestyle is according to this belief and we can have the best life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
As China becomes more powerful, Washington, as it has done before and always do as an antagonizing force, tries to bully its allies into accepting what it dictates. Most of the time, these dictates are harmful for U.S. allies, and they better do something about their foreign policy rather than following in U.S. footsteps. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, recently China's surrounding areas, especially the region of Southeast Asia, have attracted much attention with several major summits taking place. China and the U.S. are actively engaged in summit diplomacy, not only holding summit between the two sides' heads of state, but also holding bilateral dialogues with leaders of other countries, respectively, to promote their own international agendas and foreign policies. The Joe Biden administration has continued to promote regional strategy and some measures that aim to contain China in some specific areas, including technology decoupling and reshape of regional supply chains. But as China becomes more powerful, Washington has to take into consideration the security risks of competing with China and work to intensify a strategic competition with China while avoiding a military clash with China. The Biden administration was eager to meet with the Chinese head of state to avoid misjudgment and conflict and resume cooperation in areas like military exchanges, climate change, and drug control. This is because of internal and external pressures like the midterm elections, severe inflation, and several countermeasures China has put in place since Pelosi's reckless visit to Taiwan. During the summit, both sides elaborated on their own policy stances on major concerns, bilateral relations, and significant global challenges. They also reached a number of important consensus which point a clear direction to development of ties. Washington's desire to stabilize relations does not mean that it has changed its policy towards China. The Biden administration still emphasizes competition with China. Compared with the Trump administration, it pays more attention to the role of allies. The Biden administration has stepped up its diplomatic efforts with Asia-Pacific nations and seeks to isolate China by strengthening cooperation with its allies, which, however, prompted the regional countries to face the dilemma of taking sides between two major powers. However, most U.S. allies are very resistant to take sides. For example, Prime Minister of Singapore Lee Hsien Loong indicated that ASEAN member states do not want to choose sides. Canberra has also sought to mend ties with China. In addition, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz took a business delegation on his trip to Beijing recently and reached a series of cooperation agreements. The fundamental reason that this situation occurs is the contrast of strengths and differences in interest. First, it is foolish to choose sides between two rival powers. China and the U.S. are two countries with the strongest comprehensive strength and international influence in the world. The state of China-U.S. relations not only affects the cooperation and competition between the two countries, but also has a huge impact on the global situation. For other countries, it is not in their fundamental interest to get involved in confrontation between China and the U.S. or to choose sides between the two. Second, decoupling with China is not in the interest of U.S. allies and partners. China and the U.S. are the two largest economies in the world. China-U.S. relations deeply affect the world economy. In the eyes of the vast majority of countries, a decoupling of economics or technology is not conducive to their own economic development. Third, there are cognitive differences between the U.S. and its allies and partners. Most Asia-Pacific countries and some of the U.S. allies and partners have a high degree of economic dependence on China's economy, and they have different perceptions of their strategic relationships with China. The U.S. regards itself as the global hegemon and the designer and defender of the West-led international order. It has a strong hegemonic anxiety with China's rapid development. Nonetheless, U.S. allies and partners in the West, or non-Western allies, which share Western values and political ideology, have a certain degree of anxiety about China, while most other allies and partners have no obvious strategic anxiety about China and hope to benefit from China's development. In addition, China actively conducts diplomatic work, expounds China's position and policies in a timely and comprehensive manner, and provides wisdom and solutions to promote peace and development at the regional and global levels. This has made many U.S. allies and partners improve their attitude toward China. There are indications that most U.S. allies and partners do not want to choose sides between China and the U.S., and they're not to and cannot fully follow the U.S. in restricting China. This not only reflects the reality that China's strength and influence have increased significantly, but also reflects the decline of U.S. on its allies and partners, and that the political and economic coercion and value-guided methods cannot achieve the goals of the U.S. If the U.S. does not change its zero-sum thinking and understanding of China, it will be difficult to completely change its China policy and its expectations for allies and partners. However, this is not in line with the will of all countries to expect world peace and common development.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan powers policies and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. The heads of the three powers of the state, executive, legislative, judicial, expressed their sorrow and sympathized with the grieving family. Then certain elements murder other people who are innocent and have not committed any crime. How can you make false accusations and insult such a huge organization that serves the people over the probability that perhaps one or two people have made a mistake before any research or proof has been presented? There is no logic behind this. It is clearly the work of none other than the spy agencies and malicious foreign politicians. Now, what is the motive of these foreign governments? My perception is that they feel that the country is progressing towards achieving a comprehensive power, and they cannot tolerate this. They can feel this and see it.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They can see that many old problems are fortunately being solved. Although the country has many problems, some of which started years ago, but serious work is being done to solve these problems and untie these knots. They can see the movement towards progress which is accelerating in the country. This is a fact. In all areas, an accelerating movement can be seen and felt. They can see and feel this as well. They can see and feel this as well. They do not want this to happen. They can see that factories that had been almost shut down have started operating again. They can see knowledge-based companies working. They can see advanced production day by day. In some sectors, they can see things being done that can neutralize the effects of the sanctions, which is currently the enemy's only weapon. They can see these things. In order to stop this progress, they are making plans. They have plans for universities and plans for the streets.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes. particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world.